Hi, Yusuf.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm okay. Let me introduce us. You are Yusuf Munayyer, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes, that's right.
And you are the executive director of the Jerusalem Fund for Education and Community Development. Is
That's
that
right.
right? And it runs something called the Palestine Center.
Correct.
And what is that? Can you tell us briefly what that's about?
Sure. Well, the Jerusalem Fund is actually a kind of a unique organization that brings together three different programs that include cultural work, including art exhibits, humanitarian work, and then a program called the Palestine Center, which is sort of our most public face on these particular issues. And it works to sort of educate the general public about issues related to Palestine, U.S. policy towards Palestine, and the Israeli-Palestinian issue in the region in general.
Okay. And you, I gather, you're of Palestinian descent, but you actually have Israeli as well as American citizenship. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. I was born in a town called Elid, or Lod, as it's pronounced in Hebrew. And so I have Israeli citizenship. And 20% of the Israeli population is, of course, Palestinian citizens of Israel. This is the byproduct of the Nakba from 1947 to 1949. But another byproduct, of course, of that is the dispersal of Palestinians all over the region. Palestinian citizens of of Israel, like myself, very typically have family not just inside Israel, but inside the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and areas in camps and countries throughout the region. That's sort of the typical, I guess, Palestinian experience, but also very specifically for Palestinian citizens of Israel.
Okay, which brings us to Gaza, which is what we're going to mainly talk about. So, right now, I gather negotiations are going on in an attempt to create a truly enduring ceasefire. What is your take on, have you gotten any word on whether there's much progress?
Well, there's been all kinds of leaks and reporting in the past several days. They just announced this extended 5-day period of ceasefire. Before that, there was a 3-day period, and I think before that, there was another 3-day period. And throughout all of this time, we've seen leaks indicating different things. But I would be very careful to really take those leaks for anything more than unsubstantiated reports at this time, because there's a lot of questions on both sides about how this is going to be handled, how they're going to really achieve something better than the status quo. There's probably a lot of people who are leaking at this point to try to get a reaction from the public about certain terms and certain principles and so on. So I'm not sure the extent to which that actually reflects what's going on behind closed doors. But it seems like there are, more serious conversations going on now, and it's clear, obviously, that there has to be some sort of agreement that is brought forward, because we see what the military way of dealing with this has resulted in, and it obviously is not progress, so.
Right. And the kind of things on the Palestinian wish list here, and I know, and first of all, there's of course a difference of perspective on some issues between the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Hamas, but we can get into that later. In broad terms, what do you think are things that are important to the Palestinians that Israel is going to have the most reluctance to deliver?
Well, let's keep in mind first what the sort of the what the Palestinians want to see out of an agreement here. And I think a lot of a lot of this has been characterized as demands. And while I think they're right to assert what they're asking for here, they shouldn't have to demand some of these things, because some of them are very sort of basic rights and access to things that they shouldn't have been denied, in the first place. For example, Simple things like being able to fish in your own coastal waters. I mean, it's kind of absurd that this has to be the demand after, you know, a bloody conflict to let people fish, you know, off the coast of their own territory.
Yeah. Right now, there is some zone within which they, like 2 miles out or something, they are allowed to fish, but not beyond that. Is that it?
Right. So the previous agreement in 2012 was supposed to allow them to go up to 6 nautical miles, but that was then cut back down to 3 nautical miles. And you know, it sort of sounds mundane, but the reality is that most of the fish are beyond a certain point. And so you have a fishing industry in the Gaza Strip, which is, of course, a coastal territory and has had this long and thriving fishing industry for, you know, centuries on end, now has most of the fish coming into its market through farming and not through actual fishing. So that's been really devastating for the economy. And it's just, I mean, one example of one of the sort of simple things that should not have to be demanded as the result of, you know, a war, but really should be afforded to people, I think.
I assume the Israeli claim is that they have to police those waters to keep weapons from coming in, leaving aside your view on their right to do that. But I assume that's their claim, and that the larger the zone, the further out the zone goes, the harder it is for them to do that. Is that what they say?
Well, I mean, this is one of those odd claims, right, about security that doesn't really make sense. What do Palestinian fishing boats leaving from the Gaza Strip going outwards into their own waters, what sort of security threat do they present to Israel? It doesn't make sense to me at all how that, you know.
Right. What I meant is that the larger the circumference that needs to be policed, I assume, you know, as you expand the territory outwards, it's a larger border that needs to be policed is all I was. I assume if I were Israeli, that's the claim I'd make. I mean, that,
you know, maybe for them, the concern is that they're going to have to spend some, you know, some extra money on fueling the naval ships that are putting out a larger perimeter. Maybe that's what it's about. But when it comes to security, you know, it's not like they're fishing for rockets at the bottom of the 8 mile nautical mark here. You know, it's another one of these claims. For example, like the security claim about imports and exports. How does it serve Israeli security to prevent the export of strawberries from the Gaza Strip? It doesn't in any way. It doesn't serve Israeli security in any way to stop, you know, to prevent the import of certain types of foods into the Gaza Strip. I mean, this is absurd.
Mm-hmm. So your view that the actual motivation behind those policies is to weaken Hamas by ensuring that it cannot deliver prosperity?
Well, that much has been said in the past by Israeli officials. I mean, the idea has been, as they said, to put Palestinians on a diet or to keep the economy at the verge of collapse, but not right at, you know, not to collapse on itself. And I think there are many sectors of the economy that have collapsed, and in fact, many industries that have disappeared, no longer exist in the Gaza Strip since the beginning of this process. So I do think that is the intention. And if you take the argument that it is about security at its face, and you, for the sake of argument, accept it to be true, well, let's look at what this approach has actually been successful at. We see time after time militants in the Gaza Strip continue to retain the capacity both to develop and to fire longer range rockets time after time. So it's not like this is actually preventing weapons from getting in. If you put up walls and barriers and prevent the legitimate entry of goods, the illicit traffic is only going to find other ways to get in anyway. We see that not just in, of course, the Gaza Strip, but in any sort of prison context. There's always somebody that knows how to get you something. And when you have an active sort of resistance and numerous militant groups that have connections outside the Strip as well, it's really not going to matter that the crossings above ground are closed if they continue to access, you know, weapons underground and so on. So one has to really question the notion here that these policies have anything to do with security, when in fact it's clear the effect that it's had on the civilian population and the economy, and clear also that as far as the security situation is concerned, it has not really changed things. In fact, I would argue in many places it's made things worse.
Yeah. I mean, I guess Israel would say there could always be more missiles, there could always be longer range missiles and so on, and the things would be, from its point of view, worse from a security standpoint if it were easier to get stuff in and out. But anyway, I take your point that some of the motivation for this seems not to have to do with weapons. Well, it's hard to.
Yeah, let's just remember one point that I think is really important here. The reason that weapons are being used, there's the motivation for that is the occupation. And, you know, the Israelis were on the ground in the Gaza Strip for almost 40 years. And in that 40-year period, they were not able to demilitarize the Gaza Strip. So no, you know, closure of above-ground crossings is going to lead to that outcome as well. The only thing that's going to change that is addressing the legitimate grievances of the Palestinians on the ground and coming to some sort of acceptable and just agreement between the parties. There's no military solution for it, and there's not going to be any security for Israelis unless there's security as well for Palestinians.
Yeah. Okay. So that brings us back to the grievances. So what other things are the Palestinians trying to get out of these talks aside from an expansion of the fishing zone? There's also, of course, a lot of discussion about the Rafah crossing into Egypt, which had been a primary, avenue of commerce and a way of getting things in and out until this anti-Hamas government took power in Egypt, right? So that's another, I guess that's another item on the list. And then there are others as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think if most of them are encapsulated really in the Israelis abiding by previous commitments that they've already made and obligations that they have under international law. For example, Palestinians from the Gaza Strip are supposed to be able to enter the West Bank and vice versa. That's one of the things that has been prevented for a very long time now, and they'd like to see that change, obviously. They'd like to see, people be able to exit the Gaza Strip without having to have, terminal illnesses as the only, thing that allows them to get out. They want to see a genuine end to fire. I mean, this is one of the problems with previous ceasefires, is that they've been called ceasefires, but it hasn't actually ended fire, especially not from the Israeli side. One of the things that complicates this process is that on the Israeli side, you have a singular entity, an Israeli government, a unified chain of command. On the Palestinian side, you have multiple factions. And one of the biggest, grievances that the factions had, that other than Hamas, was that, a lot of their personnel, their members or so on, continued to be targeted by fire or extrajudicial assassinations, even when there wasn't rocket fire. And so they wanted guarantees from Hamas and obviously from Israel that in a ceasefire agreement that would stop. For Hamas, which is the government there, but also one of the largest militant group, for them to be able to keep these factions, under control, because they're not the only one. Hamas is not the only party launching rockets here. For them to be able to keep them under control, that agreement needs to hold up, because Hamas also doesn't want to be put in the position that, Fatah has been put in, where they're essentially, subcontracting the occupation. But increasingly in recent years, Hamas has been asked to play that role of policing other factions. It becomes very difficult to do that, though, if the Israelis continue to fire at some of these members, provoking them, and then Hamas is put in a position where it has to enforce, you know, the ceasefire again against other Palestinians. And so I don't think the Israelis have been nearly as helpful with that as they could be. And they've carried out a number of extrajudicial assassinations in the absence of rocket fire. And they also continue to fire into the Gaza Strip around the perimeter, which was something that was also supposed to come to an end under the 2012 agreement. There was a buffer zone that was agreed upon after the 2012 agreement in November that was supposed to be at 300 meters. But what we saw was that that was not enforced merely at the 300-meter mark, but also at the 500 and 1,500-meter mark, and sometimes even further than that. So you had, you know, farmers who are in this area, which comprises something like 50% of all the arable land in the Gaza Strip, because the farmland is at the perimeters and the urban areas are concentrated closer to the center, that are getting shot at in fields while they're, you know, just going about their regular lives, trying to do farming and so on. So these
are during periods when Hamas is effectively enforcing the ceasefire from its end, and actually it had been doing a pretty good job of that since the previous war until war broke out this time. But I assume that whenever Israel does this, it claims some provocation or not.
Well, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And sometimes it turns out that the provocation never really happened or wasn't really a provocation. When it comes to, you know, the so-called buffer zone and firing into the buffer zone, you know, there's all sorts of claims that, you know, people were doing this or that or rioting or what have you. The reality is they're well inside the Gaza Strip. Many of these people have been shot when they've been unarmed. Some people have been shot merely collecting scrap metal or farming, as I've said. And, you know, these are the kind of things that provoke a reaction from some of the factions, even if it's not Hamas, to do something to respond because they feel that the ceasefire has been breached. You know, you also have one of the explicit, by the way, parts of the 2012 agreement was an end to assassinations. And, you know, the Israelis have claimed the right to assassinate militants in the Gaza Strip if they believe that they are possibly going to do something in the future, not actively engaged in firing rockets. Of course, there's no proof of this. There's no independent corroboration of these Israeli claims. And so for, you know, militants who are facing these assassinations, it's a very provocative act. So there's a lot of problems here. If you look, by the way, the sequence that began earlier this year in June, it began long before these three Israeli teenagers went missing and were subsequently murdered. It actually began prior to that in the Gaza Strip with an exchange of fire. The Israelis fired into the Gaza Strip in response to what they said was rocket fire. And then after investigation, it turned out there was no rocket that was fired. So sometimes you...
And this was... Yeah. This was how far before the kidnapping?
This was in the first week of June. The kidnapping was on the 12th, I believe. There was a series of Israeli ceasefire violations in the first week of June that nobody talks about, nobody pays attention to. Because of, you know, other events obviously took the spotlight. Well,
do you think the kidnapping was a response to that or what?
No, not necessarily. I mean, the dynamics of fire in the Gaza Strip are going on almost on a daily basis. And unless you're watching them on a daily basis at a really sort of, very small scale, you're not going to understand the back and forth between the Israeli military and some of these smaller factions, which are the ones that are really involved in the vast majority of fire during ceasefire periods. The Israeli press actually reported that it was not until the Israelis struck numerous Hamas targets in the Gaza Strip this June that Hamas fired their first rocket since the 2012 ceasefire. So they had actually.
Other groups had been. I mean, other groups had been firing rockets out of Gaza in the days before that, but not Hamas.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct. And actually, in 2012, You know, the lead up to the 2012 war was largely Islamic Jihad. It wasn't Hamas. It wasn't until the assassination of Ahmed Jaberi, who was the sort of the head of the Hamas, you know, military and intelligence wing.
And why was it that Hamas was in the days before the first Hamas missile less effective in suppressing Islamic Jihad rocket fire than it had been for most of the previous, you know?
Well, the Islamic Jihad episode, that was more in 2012. I think prior to this episode, the faction that was involved was the PRC, which is the Popular Resistance Committees. And I think one of the more under-discussed reasons for the PRC's involvement in the immediate lead-up to the Israeli operation was the rearrest of many of these prisoners that were released during the Shalit deal in the West Bank. And what few people know, actually, is that the capture of Gilad Shalit was one of the first and most well-known operations that the Popular Resistance Committees, which is one of these factions, actually took part in. So it was very much their claim to fame among the militant groups in the
Gaza. So did Hamas not initiate that kidnapping?
Oh, they were part. No, they were certainly part of it. But they were joined in by this other faction as well. Okay. So you have to understand that among many of these smaller factions, you know, there is a struggle among them for you know, who can claim to be the most effective and the most successful and so on. And those dynamics are, you know, for most observers, well below the surface and not something that they're really going to understand if it's just discussed as a sort of Israel-Hamas dichotomy here. But doing that really misses a lot of the important things that are going on.
Okay. So your interpretation of how we found ourselves in war this time, I mean, the two kind of diametrically opposed narratives are, first of all, the one that's probably most prevalent in America, which is, you know, just for unknown reasons, Hamas starts firing missiles into Israel and then Israel has to defend itself. On the other side, the narrative is more like, okay, there was this kidnapping, but it doesn't seem to have been to have come from Hamas Central. And Netanyahu acted as if it had come from Hamas Central and used that as a pretext to do all kinds of things that were a provocation to Hamas and to other groups, I guess. And that's what actually started the war, right? I gather you would lean more toward the latter narrative, but it's probably too simplified as well, or what?
Yeah, I think that is too simplified, but I think it's certainly more true than the other way around. I think, you know, you have to remember that during ceasefire periods, the situation in the Gaza Strip is still constantly on edge. All it takes is one Israeli strike into the Gaza Strip to set off a reaction. And then once you have that reaction, you'll have another reaction to that. And if that inflicts a number of casualties, you'll have a bigger reaction from the Palestinian side and so on and so forth. And that's how the ceasefire crumbles, right? And we've seen multiple sort of flare-up periods during ceasefires, which have ultimately been, tamped down and things go back to a sort of, ceasefire status quo that follow these flare-up periods. But what you had here was a couple things. You had a flare-up period starting to happen in the Gaza Strip at the same time as you had this, massive sort of Israeli collective punishment response to what should have been a more straightforward and targeted, criminal investigation in the West Bank that fueled, I think, this the events that we ended up seeing. But I think until you had the Israeli strikes against Hamas targets in Gaza, that was really the singular event that took what could have been a containable situation and made it a one that was not containable at all.
Now, and prior to that, as I understand it, there had been missiles that had come from Gaza, but those were not Hamas missiles prior to the Israeli strikes on Hamas targets in Gaza. Is that right?
Correct, correct. And those, I mean, again, this is something we watch on a daily basis. One of the things that, that we do is we actually catalog every, you know, every ceasefire violation mm-hmm. from the Israeli side and every, you know, projectile that comes from the Gaza Strip. So in mm-hmm. the first week of June, you didn't have any rockets or projectiles fired from Gaza, but you did have a series of Israeli ceasefire violations, at least as defined by the terms of the 2012 ceasefire, at mm-hmm. least four of them. And then on the 9th, I believe it was, of June, you began to see projectile fire response from the Gaza Strip. And again, the, you know, the...
And this is after the kidnapping and after BB's crackdown.
No, this is before.
Okay.
This is before. Okay. So on the 12th, you know, several days later. But in some ways, you know, the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, you know, are very disconnected when it comes to these military dynamics. I mean, many things going on in the West Bank are often, you know, they're not responded to by, you know, militants in the Gaza Strip. But I think what we saw was mm-hmm. different this time. Particularly because the rearrest of many of these Shalit deal prisoners, that you began to see a response to those actions in the West Bank from the Gaza Strip. And that was something a little bit more unique, and I think kind of speaks to a closing of the ranks between just not just the territories, but also, you know, the parties that are involved.
And do you know why Hamas was less successful at this point in repressing the rocket fire from other groups in Gaza? This is before Hamas starts fire, before the Israeli strikes on Hamas targets.
I don't think they were necessarily less successful. I think there are, you know, flare-up periods in which those periods, I think, could potentially be a lot worse if not for some of the efforts of mm-hmm. Hamas in the Gaza Strip. But, you know, when these periods start to escalate, it becomes increasingly difficult to get them under control. And you mm-hmm. have Hamas, again, as I mentioned, in this precarious position where they are forced to be the defenders of Israel's security, which kind of goes, you know, very much against the notion of resistance, which is one that they, you know, one that they
right.
obviously want to claim. So... you know, it's not easy for them to cut all of this stuff out. And I think if you look at during the ceasefire period, what they were able to do, they actually were tremendously effective. And I think there were a number of Israeli security sources quoted in the Israeli media saying something to that effect. But once, you know, you have an escalation and certainly once a war begins, you know, all bets are going to be off, and it becomes then, you know, really a direct confrontation with all parties involved.
Okay. Now, you said earlier, you know, the root of the problem is the occupation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly, that's exactly what the Palestinian Authority would say. They would say the root of the problem is the occupation of the West Bank and of Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing Israelis will point out when you, you know, ask them why they seem so militant in their policy toward Hamas is that that's not exactly what Hamas says, right? I mean, Hamas doesn't say that if Israel got out of the West Bank and Gaza, everything would be fine, right? I mean, the official aspiration of Hamas remains, well, let's just say they define the settlement as encompassing, I mean, they define the occupation as encompassing Israel proper. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple points on that. First of all, I think it's largely a distraction more than anything else, because it misses two relevant pieces of information. The first is that, yes, there are things that Hamas has said that indicate, you know, maximalist positions. There are also things that Hamas said that indicate different positions. And I think that understanding where they really lie on this issue, particularly when you consider that they are not a unitary group, that is, it's not monolithic. There's a variety of opinions there. That if you look at only one, you know, statement that they've made, or only a couple statements, while not looking at everything that they've done and also the rest of their behavior, you're probably going to misunderstand them. The other thing that I would point out is that, you know, it's odd to watch the discourse on this, where, you know, so many people, whether it's analysts or policymakers, or even, you know, journalists, are very quick to be able to recite the charter of Hamas or parts of it or so on. And none of them even know anything about the contents of charters of other parties that are involved in this situation on both sides. Few people know, for example, that the Likud charter, quote, flatly rejects the existence of a Palestinian state west of the Jordan River. That's in the West Bank and Gaza, anywhere west of the Jordan River.
And is that still true? There was some revision of Likud's charter at some point.
As far as I'm aware, they have never officially changed that language. There's been a lot of, you know, attempts to kind of say otherwise publicly by certain leaders, particularly Benjamin Netanyahu, who's come under some pressure to at least state that, you know, he would support one day the existence of some form of Palestinian state to keep this, you know, this facade of the peace process alive. But at the same time, you know, if you look at the statements of others within Likud and the actual makeup of the Likud party, you have people far to the right of not just Benjamin Netanyahu, but the language of that charter that I quoted for you earlier. So, you know, I am less concerned about, you know, the outdated statements of the, you know, one particular party in this, which is under occupation and does not have the capacity at its disposal to achieve its stated ambitions or supposedly stated ambitions, then I am concerned about a party that's actually leading a state that can carry out its ambitions and is and does through the continued expansion of settlements in the West Bank. So, you know, I feel like this is a real distraction from the main problem here. And it's not, you know, it's kind of disingenuous to put it out there as the primary obstacle to what's going on.
So I mean, one thing you'd say is the engaging in negotiations with a Likud-led government, as we have, I guess, more than once, presupposes that charters are not ultimately binding and you shouldn't be too constrained. You know, it presupposes that whatever they say is subject to change. But just kind of for the record, I mean, I've always been curious what does the Hamas charter say? I've never actually read it. I mean, how bad is it? I mean, you know, it's plainly the case that Hamas's leaders have said more moderate things over in recent years and have pretty much said that, in effect, the subtext is, yes, there could be a path to a two-state solution. But what does the actual charter say?
Sure. Well, I think there are translations of the charter, and it says all kinds of things, including quoting all kinds of, you know, religious language and edicts and all kinds of claims. As a political document, it's a very sort of immature document. And I think that the organization has, you know, developed a lot in terms of its political savvy since the actual drafting of that document. But, you know, one should remember that, you know, historical documents like that only tell us so much. I mean, if one was to look at the U.S. Constitution today without, say, the amendments that followed it, one would get a completely different idea of what the United States is. Because obviously the changes that followed are kind of significant in terms of defining what we are as a country today. And while we don't have that kind of system in Palestine to you know, legislate changes to historical documents, and we haven't seen that as much with Hamas. A lot of the statements and positions that they've made and taken over time show a change in the position of the organization. For example, in, I believe it was 2006, 2007, at some point, there was a document signed. It was known as the Prisoners Agreement. And it was an agreement that was signed by various heads of the different Palestinian political factions, most of which were in prison at the time, on a common sort of strategic objective and opposing the division of Palestinian political parties. And what was remarkable about that at the time is there was an implicit recognition of Israel at the time, not an explicit one, but an implicit one that Hamas leaders signed on to as well. So, and they've said on numerous occasions that if a two-state agreement was agreed on by the Israeli leadership and the PLO, and was put to a public referendum of Palestinians, that they would abide by it. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, the positions of Hamas, the positions of Naftali Bennett's party, the positions of Netanyahu's party, the positions of the Islamic Jihad, they're all going to have, you know, different views about how this thing is going to be settled. But if there is ever going to be a lasting agreement between both sides here, it has to be negotiated between representative leaders of the stakeholders on both sides. And mm-hmm. without that, you know, we're not, you know, we're not really going to get anywhere at all. So those voices have to be included, and there needs to be an agreement that, you know, is brought forward through that process. And then if it is one that is supported publicly by the people, I think they've said that they would abide by it. And I think that's an important difference than, you know, taking simply the statements of this one document from the late 1980s that really rant, you know, reads more like a rant than anything else, to understand the behavior and positions of this organization.
Okay. Now, one reason Israel, probably the primary reason, the primary thing it cites when it kind of refuses to deal directly with Hamas in negotiations and so on, is this is a terrorist organization. Now, you were on Fox News not that long ago, speaking with Sean Hannity, mm-hmm. Whom I think you probably have some ideological differences with. Mm-hmm. And he did this thing where he said, is Hamas a terrorist organization? And every time you started to answer in a way that indicated you were going to say anything other than yes or no, that you were going to like use a whole sentence or more to answer the question,
right,
he would cut you off and say right. yes or no. You know, and so you never answered. What would you have said?
Yeah, well, and I've expanded on this elsewhere. I think there are certain questions that, you know, you don't really learn very much from by simple yes or no answers. And certainly when it comes mm-hmm. to the Middle East, you know, black and white is probably not the best way to kind of approaching the understanding of complexities in the area. So mm-hmm. I did not want to reduce the discussion to something like that, because I think it's far more complicated. You know, and as I told him then on the program, I said the United States government, you know, obviously considers Hamas to be a terrorist organization. And, you know, obviously the reason that I said that is because the United States actually has particularly the State Department, which designates foreign terrorist organizations, has a working definition of what that is, that they go by. But the actual definition of terrorism is not something that is shared throughout the United States government. Different agencies have different definitions of terrorism. And if you ask people around the world what is terrorism and what does it mean and how they view Hamas, those answers also change. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I think that, you know, Hamas is a resistance movement, a political party, and I think they've also used tactics that we can all agree target civilians for political aims, which is the you know, most common sort of accepted definition of what terrorism is. But I think to reduce the organization to simply a terrorist organization does not lend in any way to our understanding of the organization or its behavior or how to affect its behavior or what its concerns are and how to deal with it. So, you know, Fox News might thrive on the black and white world, but I don't think that's going to help us move forward in any way in the complex situation that is the Israeli-Palestinian issue.
Okay. So you would say it has used tactics that, by pretty mainstream definition, are terrorist tactics in the past.
Yeah, and that's I don't think that's something that is really in dispute. I mean, right. what I think is you know, distracting is when we talk about the use of violence against civilians, you know, for the purpose of political aims, as if it's only done by, you know, non-state actors or people with, you know, particular political agendas, and ignore the same sort of tactics that are used by state actors or people with different political agendas that might be more in line with the, you know, regional strategic objectives of the United States government. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, are there tactics that have been used by Israel that you think could qualify as terrorists by a reasonable definition?
Well, when you look at, for example, the siege of the Gaza Strip, you have here the indiscriminate collective punishment of 1.8 million civilians, largely civilians, for the purpose of achieving political aims. I mean, if we're talking about the strict definition of terrorism, or if we can agree upon a definition of terrorism, I think this is a tactic that has instilled, you know, terror into people in the Gaza Strip for years now. And I think there are plenty of other acts of state terror that are being committed by the Israelis and other states as well. So I think, you know, one of the major problems in the discourse on terrorism is it's largely limited to non-state actors. You know, it's not a coincidence that the actors that define on a sort of at an international level what terrorism is happen to be state actors. And that the people who are targeted the most through the use of these, you know, rules and laws that are constructed by state actors are non-state actors. So a lot of this is really about the, you know, the maintenance of a particular system and the repression and exclusion of a particular, you know, political movements from a larger conversation about how things should be in the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Final question, I guess. You know, before this, there was some speculation that before the war started, Bibi Netanyahu wasn't exactly averse to like generating a little turmoil, in part because he was frightened by this prospect of a Hamas-Palestinian Authority unity government. Which was in the works, and now, I guess what is envisioned as some sort of longer term, you know, ceasefire here, is that Palestinian Authority would wind up, you know, playing a very, you know, large and even dominant role in providing security, maybe at crossings and so on, but at the same time, there is either explicit or implicit in this envisioned scenario, you know, a kind of a cooperative relationship between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, right? And I guess that's led some people to ask, you know, isn't Bibi going to wind up with what he was so opposed to in some sense or another?
Well, you know, time will tell how that's going to work out. But, you know, as you noted, there was an agreement between the PLO and Hamas, you know, in April. And, you know, just to correct one thing, a lot of people have made this mistake. It was not for a unity government. It was for a national reconciliation government. And these are two very, very different things, because in the unity government, all of the parties would have been participating in the government. But that's not the case here. You have, in the government that was formed, independents and technocrats that were not members of any of the parties in any official way. And the reason that was constructed was so that this, you know, independent government would be able to transition into a period where we could have elections for the Legislative Council, which then in theory could put things back on track to something resembling more normal parliamentary government. But I mean, you're right about the fact that the Palestinian reconciliation was something that disturbed the Israelis very much, because the Israelis benefit tremendously from division of Palestinians and being able to, you know, make the claim that, oh, we don't have a partner. At one point they say, well, you know, Hamas needs to be excluded, but at the other time they say, well, you know, Abbas cannot deliver anything. So it provides sort of, you know, excuses to move forward on ending the occupation. And it allows the Israelis to simultaneously continue on with their project of expanding in the West Bank and entrenching the occupation there. So it is something that bothers the Israelis very much. They'd like to see the Palestinians divided, and particularly like to see a lack of unity between the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And if you look at, you know, the comments that were made by Ariel Sharon's top aide at the time of the Gaza, what they called disengagement in 2005, mm-hmm. What he said is that the disengagement is formaldehyde for the peace process. And I think that's exactly how it's really worked out. It's led to a division, not only a physical division between the administration of Gaza and the West Bank, but also a split politically between Palestinian factions that have given Israel a convenient excuse, or at least an excuse that falls on sympathetic ears in the halls of power here in Washington, D.C., to avoid any serious engagement in a process that would bring an end to the occupation. So I think, yeah, they want to see as much division among Palestinians as possible. And the outcome of this, you know, we'll see what really happens here. I think that what we've heard so far is that it is going to look something like that. But I think also we saw, even from the United States after the reconciliation agreement was signed, was a willingness to accept a move in this direction, which I think is very important, because ultimately if Washington is behind that, then the Israelis will at some point have to deal with it. I think, you know, it serves the interests of everybody involved to have more legitimate representation of the Palestinian stakeholders in this issue, because that's the only way that you're going to have a path forward to an agreement that's negotiated between the parties. Now, another sort of irony here is in this strategy of, quote, bolstering the moderates. Many people have looked at the situation in Gaza and said, well, you know, it would be really problematic if, you know, Hamas ends up getting some sort of political victory out of this, and it would weaken Abbas in relation to them, and that we have to find a way to deliver for Abbas a political victory here so that, you know, he could be further legitimized, and that a more moderate, quote, moderate party would be leading the Palestinians and so on and so forth. The problem, of course, is that this completely misunderstands how legitimacy is generated among Palestinians. And anyone who thinks that the interests of Mahmoud Abbas as a legitimate leader to Palestinians are going to be served by bringing him into the Gaza Strip on the backs of Israeli tanks or in the wake of a war that's killed 2,000 Palestinians there is really out of their mind. But that, you know, that is the conventional thinking by policymakers here on this issue. And it completely fails to understand Palestinian domestic political dynamics. So I think that, you know, Palestinians need to be allowed to choose their own leaders. Israelis should be allowed to choose their own leaders. And if Washington can play a credible role of bringing legitimate representatives together to hash out an agreement, then great. But if that's not what's going on, then we're really just fooling ourselves with distractions here.
Okay. Actually, one more question related. There have been reports. There was a story, I think, in the Washington Post saying that actually during this last war, you know, the patience of people in Gaza with Hamas was beginning to wear thin. And in other words, you were getting the effect that some in Israel hoped for, which is that the people in Gaza would start blaming their suffering on Hamas in the wake of this very devastating war. Do you attach any credence to that?
You know, it's a very, very interesting question. I'm glad you brought it up, because another thing that happened at the beginning of all of this was the release of a very interesting study, and I would encourage anyone to look at it, about Israeli political dynamics in the wake of rocket fire and extended rocket range. And what was so interesting about that, and I think it's actually illustrative about how, you know, how polities really respond in wartime and so on, was that what they found was Israeli constituencies which came under rocket fire were more likely to vote for right-wing parties. And even if the governments failed to prevent rocket fire, they didn't hold them accountable for that. They continued to support right-wing parties. And the more constituencies that came under rocket range, in the next election, they voted for right-wing parties as well, instead of holding them accountable for the lack of security and the failure to put forward effective policy to deal with the issue, which I think is very interesting. And I think on the Palestinian side, you know, it's going to be very difficult to get Palestinians to be convinced that other Palestinians are the reason to blame for their situation when it is Israeli bombs that are dropping on their houses. Palestinians know very well why they're in the situation that they're in. They know very well why they're in refugee camps in the Gaza Strip. Some 80% of the population is there. It's not because of Hamas. You know, the Nakba was long before Hamas even existed. The occupation began of the Gaza Strip long before Hamas existed. And this, you know, to think that Palestinians aren't savvy enough to understand what's going on here, I think is not giving them enough credit. But that being said, one thing that I've been wondering about, and I've heard actually from a number of people that I've talked to in the Gaza Strip who are not, you know, Hamas loyalists, is that there's an effect that we're seeing now where a number of people are actually gravitating towards Hamas and towards the other resistance parties because they see the resistance as legitimate. And I've been thinking recently about a historical example, and I wonder the extent to which we might see something similar here, and that was the 1968 Battle of Karameh, which was a battle that happened inside Jordan near a town called Karameh, which interestingly means dignity or honor in English. And what happened in that situation is that in the wake of the 1967 war, where, of course, the Israelis defeated, you know, a number of state armies in a very short period of time, there was almost a sense of invincibility and a sense of utter despair that many Palestinians had in confronting this massive, you know, Israeli military force and effective military force. But in this small battle that took place in 1968 across the border, the Palestinian militants along with the Jordanian army were able to inflict some heavy losses on the Israelis, even though there was tremendous damage to the refugee camp and there was tremendous losses on the Palestinian side. Just the idea that they were able to inflict these losses led to a complete change in the understanding of the enemy and what was possible in relation to them. And the ranks of the PLO began to swell, and they became a much more solidified and popular Palestinian response to the Israelis. And I wonder the extent to which we might see something like that in the wake of this, because even though there's been tremendous destruction, a number of people will point to the amount of losses that Palestinians were able to inflict on the Israeli side. And I think that what we're going to see is that the resistance factions are probably going to be able to garner a good deal more support for their ranks because of those successes. So, you know, I doubt it's going to be as influential as that historical example, but nonetheless, I don't think at all it's going to have the effect that's mentioned in that Washington Post article. And the people that I've been talking to have already began to discuss how it's happening, how it's having a different effect.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you, Yusuf. Thanks for taking all the time. Sure. And I think the situation is not going to go away anytime soon. So I hope you'll come back every once in a while.
Happy
and,
to.
Fill us in. Okay. Well, take care.
Take care. Bye, Bob.
Bye. Thank you.